CBS Radio now invites you to spend the next hour with Edward R. Murrow and eight members of the CBS News Distinguished Staff of Correspondents. This is the 10th annual edition of Years of Crisis. Here is Mr. Murrow.
This is the 10th year we have sat around this table and discussed world affairs. During that period, our country has rearmed, parleyed, shed blood in Korea, made solemn commitments all around the world, spent vast treasure to support what is left of the free world. 10 years ago, the flashpoint of crisis was Berlin, and today it's Berlin again. But before we begin this discussion, perhaps you gentlemen would introduce yourselves.
David Schoenbrunn, based in Paris, covering French and Western Union affairs.
I'm Winston Burdett. I'm stationed in Rome, but spend a good deal of time in the Middle East.
Peter Kalischer, based in Tokyo, covering the Far East.
Paul Niven, until recently, Moscow.
I'm Richard C. Hottolett, back from special assignment in Latin America.
This is Ernest Leiser, covering Germany and the East European satellites.
Charles Collingwood, London, and all sorts of odd places, latterly Africa.
Eric Severide, Washington, D.C.
Well, now that we're all checked in, gentlemen, what do you regard as the most important development of the past 10 years in your area? Schoenbrunn?
As viewed from Paris, Ed, this has been a decade of evolution and revolution. That is, the steady growth of European Economic Union and the equally steady decline of the Fourth Republic of France, whose final collapse this year brought back to power Charles de Gaulle.
Burdett?
In the Middle East, the main development has been the victory of Arab nationalism, which in these 10 years has succeeded in expelling the West from nearly all its political bastions in the area.
Pete Kalischer, what's the most important development of the past 10 years in the Far East?
The swift rise of China under communism to the status of world power, and the fascination this holds for the backward nations of Asia.
Niven?
The enormous growth of Soviet power, still widely underestimated.
Dick Hottolett?
In the Western Hemisphere, successive shocks have shattered traditions and illusions. Now, at last, we're all taking a new look at our vast problems and potential.
Eric Severide.
Well, the United States really began the practical and rather painful break with its past. We committed ourselves permanently to the world at large with our eyes about half open.
Ernie Leiser from Germany.
The most dramatic development of the decade in mid-Europe has been the emergence of West Germany to wealth and power, and the striking of a new balance of power along the line that divides Germany and Europe. And the Berlin crisis, Ed, shows that by now any attempt to change that balance drastically by either side carries with it the risk of the big war.
Charles Collingwood.
In the last 10 years, the British have had to come to terms with the fact that they can no longer, by themselves, exercise a decisive influence on the fate of the world. This realization now determines their foreign policy, their defense policy, and their national psychology.
All right, gentlemen, let's come down to the present. What was the most important development in your area this year? Leiser?
Well, the event that exploded over the middle of Europe in 1958, Ed, was, of course, the Soviet demand that we get out of Berlin. For the first 10 months of the year, not much happened to shift the balance of power in Central Europe. The division of Germany grew noticeably deeper, and Poland was pulled back into tighter check by Moscow. On our side of the line, the West German army shaped up for the first time as a real addition to Western military strength, and the Russians made it clear that they didn't like this one bit. But still, nobody on our side thought that Khrushchev would venture to throw down a fundamental new challenge to the power balance. However, he did just that. In mid-November, he suddenly spoke up to say that the West had forfeited any right to be in Berlin and that we must pull our forces out. And a couple of weeks later, Russia spelled out its plan for an undefended free city in the western sectors of Berlin, with the German communist regime in control of the traffic lifelines to that free city. And the Russians gave us a 6-month deadline to accept their plan and prepare to pull out of Berlin. We responded in the only way that we felt we could under direct threat. We've said over and over again since the war that we are in Berlin by right, exactly the same right as the Russians. Failure to stand up for our rights in so critical a place and on so basic an issue would destroy confidence in our strength and in our dependability all over the world. So we rejected Khrushchev's demand. We turned it down flatly. And that's where we are today. The Russians are still saying to us, witness Andrei Gromyko's Christmas Day speech, "You must get out of Berlin or else." The West is still answering Moscow, You bear full responsibility for the results of any attempt to squeeze us out.
Ernest, I don't think the Russians are really trying to squeeze us out. It's rather the opposite. They're pulling the rug out from under us. They pull back the Red Army and challenging us to get out, too.
Unfortunately, this will have the same effect, Dave. If the Russians do turn over their controls to the East Germans, then the East Germans will be in control of the lifelines to Berlin, and they've said that they don't want us there, and they're very probably not going to let us into Berlin.
And let's not forget that East Germany is stiff with Soviet troops.
Well, we've got a lot of Western troops around there. Do you think there's a danger of a clash, Ernest?
I don't think there's an immediate danger of a clash, Dave. I do think, though, that a test will come when we begin an airlift to Berlin, if it comes to that point.
Well, the 15 NATO nations stood up in Paris a few days ago and said that they would remain in Berlin, but they didn't agree as to what they would do if the Russians keep the pressure on and do, in fact, pull back, right?
That's absolutely correct, Ed. The present plans say that we're going to go into Berlin and demand free access. The danger of a clash will come if the East Germans try to stop us, and the Russians have said that if we fight the East Germans, they will regard it as an attack upon themselves.
Ed, I think, with all due deference to NATO, the final decision will be up to Washington, up to the United States, whether we are determined to remain in Berlin.
Well, we can't settle that now, can we? Kalischer, what was the most important development in the Far East this year?
Quemoy. Just before Red China's attack on Quemoy last August, there were secret talks in Peking between Khrushchev and Mao Zedong. Red China was sure it had a winning formula to take Quemoy without clashing directly with the United States, a sea artillery blockade that pointed up the political as well as military vulnerability of the island only 5 miles off the China mainland. For a time, this formula worked, and then we raised the ante. U.S. Navy ships began escorting nationalist supply convoys up to 3 miles off Quemoy's beach. Those 3 miles were as close as either side got to the brink of a major war. But by October, the blockade was broken, and the communists eventually settled for an every-other-day ceasefire. We, through our supplies, and the nationalists by stubborn valor, had won a temporary military victory. We had not backed down in the face of force, but the storm in the Formosa Strait had whipped up a storm at home. Why had we risked a big war over islands of doubtful value? Weren't 80,000 nationalist troops sitting in the mouth of a communist port a provocation for attack? President Chiang Kai-shek painfully declared he never considered Quemoy as an attack base to regain the mainland, and added he had largely renounced force as a means of getting there. Secretary Dulles shocked the nationalists by saying he thought it doubtful that Chiang would ever be called on to lead a mainland revolt. Dulles backed off that statement later, but a major premise of our China policy had been fractured. One of its chief supporters had admitted publicly that Chiang had no real chance for a comeback.
Winston Burdett, what was the most important development in the Middle East?
It was the revolution in Iraq. Only 6 months ago, we were all still thinking of Iraq as an island of stability in a stormy area. It was tied to the West by the Baghdad Pact. It was enjoying the benefits of more than $200 million a year in oil revenues. And it was carrying out the biggest building program in roads, schools, and dams since the Mongol invasions. Iraq had a likable young king and a prime minister, Nouri es-Said, who for sheer ability was the grand champion of all Mideast politicians, and under him the country went through the motions of parliamentary democracy. All of this, parliament, prime minister, king, and dynasty, was swept away in a one-day revolution. Obviously, we had been wrong about Iraq. Her stability had been an optical illusion. We had forgotten that her old regime was widely unpopular, her democracy a sham, her elections rigged, her press gagged, and her newly educated classes excluded from leadership. Above all, the Baghdad Pact itself was detested. In the eyes of the Iraqi nationalists, the pact was just a new tag for the old subservience to a foreign power, Britain, an alliance that cut Iraq off from the mainstream of Arab nationalism. It was the coup in Iraq that sent American troops into Lebanon and British troops to Jordan. Those operations did hold back the tide for a while, but they changed nothing and produced no solutions. They merely prevented something worse from happening. The revolt in Iraq proved again that nationalism is the ruling force in the Arab world today, stronger than kings and politicians and even military alliances.
Schoenbrunn, the most important event of the year as viewed from Paris.
The death of a republic was the big development in France this year, Ed. After a long illness, the Fourth Republic suffered a fatal stroke on May 13th when a frenzied mob of colonials led by jingoist colonels stormed government headquarters in Algiers and seized power, calling for the return of Charles de Gaulle. Now, these were angry but also frightened men. They feared that the futile politicians of the Fourth Republic were going to abandon them to the Algerian rebels under big power pressure. And they felt that only Charles de Gaulle could end the long series of cabinet crises and stand up for France against the world if necessary. In this respect, the second coming of Charles de Gaulle is more than just a French development. For de Gaulle is bigger than France in the same sense that Churchill was bigger than Britain in 1940. For in human affairs, the whole effort of a people is often greater than the sum of the separate parts. De Gaulle proved that during the last war, when, with virtually no men, no money of his own, he imposed his will upon such men as Churchill and Roosevelt. And in 1958, de Gaulle has already demonstrated that he means to make people respect the will of France once again. He took a strongly independent line, as you gentlemen know, on the Western exchange of notes with Khrushchev on a summit conference this summer. He's called for a reorganization of NATO, a reexamination of global strategy by the West. And in Africa, Charles de Gaulle made history in 1958. He offered freedom to the 18 colonies of France, and only one of them, Guinea, chose independence. The other 17 voted freely to give de Gaulle at least a chance to build a new Franco-African community. And in Algeria, he offered amnesty and peace to the rebels, inviting them to come to France for ceasefire talks and calling them brave men. And by so doing, de Gaulle proved that he was a brave man himself, for no other French politician could dare praise the rebels and offer his hand in peace. To the Muslim peoples, de Gaulle promised political, social equality, and a huge investment program if they were to stay united with France. And Charles de Gaulle does not make idle promises. Thus, 1958 began in despair, and it has ended with the glimmerings of hope, but only the glimmerings. Not one major problem has really been solved, but the means and the man to solve them have been galvanized, and that, however fragile, is a most important development for France, and I would suggest for all of us.
David, one question. Does de Gaulle's independent line make this alliance weaker or stronger?
Weaker, I think. Stronger if something is done about carrying out the things he's asked us to do.
Well, gentlemen, we've been talking here about three old men, de Gaulle, Adenauer, and Chiang Kai-shek. What happens when they depart this earthly scene? Who or what follows de Gaulle, David?
Disaster. The fate of France is really in the hands of that one man, and that's not healthy yet, even if he is, and he is not, in the prime of youth. If anything were to happen to Charles de Gaulle, I think that French democracy might die with him. This danger may not be imminent, but as with the destiny of any one man, it is ever present.
Ernie, what happens when Adenauer dies?
I think West Germany, Ed, will go along pretty much the same path it's now following. I think it will remain an ally of the West. I wouldn't have been so sure of this 5 years ago, but the country has become quite stable. I think also that the successors to Adenauer will find that they have no other place to go.
Pete Kelleher, what happens after Chiang departs?
Well, Chiang has already announced that he won't run for president again in 1960. He said this before, but if he does or he doesn't, the real behind-the-scenes power in Formosa will be exercised by his son, Ching Kuo, who runs the political section or the stooping and pooping department. In many ways, Ching Kuo runs the government now.
Charlie, what's the most important development of the year in Britain?
Well, the British have, of course, reacted to all these great and shaking things that we've been talking about. They've been shaken like the rest. But in their own terms, the most important thing that's happened to them was economic. They saved the pound. A year ago, the pound sterling, which finances half the world's trade, seemed on the rocks. And since then, by a combination of strict controls, public and private restraint, high exports, particularly to us, and a considerable measure of good luck, the British not only reestablished international confidence in their currency, but added impressively to their precious reserves of gold and dollars. And they underlined it this last weekend by taking a considerable financial risk and moving to make the pound convertible with the dollar.
They're saving the pound some more, is that right?
No, it's proof that they've saved it, Ed. And this economic factor is very important to the British, who have to trade to live. The biggest cloud at the year's end is also economic. The British are very disturbed at the prospect of a new restrictive factor being introduced into European trade by France, Germany, Italy, the Benelux countries, the six of the common market. When they joined together in a common market and denied those advantages to the rest of Europe, It spelled to the British not European unity, but European division. And it spells the same thing to the Swedes and the Swiss and the other countries outside the common market. This constant struggle to keep trade flowing is always important to the British.
Well, does this mean there's going to be a trade war between Britain and France?
I think the trade war already started last weekend with the currency moves. As long as the common market sets up a protectionist island in the middle of Europe, the other 11 nations of Europe are going to have to take retaliatory measures. How long or how intense it will be remains, I suppose, subject to negotiation.
Charles, that's not really fair to call it a protective island in Europe.
I didn't call it a protective island. I called it a protectionist island.
Well, let's say protectionist, then. It's no more protectionist, for example, than the Commonwealth itself or the United States of America. It's a big trading market. However, it's true there are going to be discriminations. These six nations are going to give themselves privileges that they won't give to the others, just as New York gives privileges to California that it doesn't give to the Germans. And there I agree with you completely. The outlines of a trade war are very definitely shaping up.
Well, then we do agree.
Well, good. Adelaide, what was the most important event down south?
Certainly the most dramatic event was Vice President Richard Nixon's goodwill tour to South America, on which he narrowly escaped being beaten to death. This shocking incident roused wild fears of anti-Americanism, which were happily not justified. But it did show that the wave of nationalism which has swept the world has stirred up forces in South America, too, and that these forces could be captured and turned against us. Nevertheless, I'd say on balance that 1958 has been a year of very hopeful change. In half a dozen countries, free and clean elections have put new leaders into office, and the voters have supported moderation and austerity. One ex-dictator was slapped down, one still dictator is slipping. A pattern seems to be emerging. The armed forces, who have always had the final say in Latin America, now seem to be supporting constitutional authority. And in this authority, the people play a larger, more responsible role. However, 1958 is not the millennium. It's at best a good beginning.
You know, this is about the first time in 10 years that I've heard Hotlet even mildly optimistic. Wouldn't you say that's right?
Yes.
First time he went down to South America.
Let me ask Hotlet a question at this point, if we have time here, Ed. Most of these countries in Latin America have been in and out of democratic attempts for generations. Why is the attempt right now so very different?
Because I think they've faced up to the reality that they're not going to be bailed out inevitably, that the problems that face them are so complex that the old sort of gimcrack dictatorship and strongmen and periodic rescue by a new military junta is not enough. As a matter of fact, the military itself says that there is hope for the future, for the military as well as the civilian authorities and forces, only on the basis of a stable economy and society.
Dick, did you hear any talk in Latin America about a common free trade area, common market?
Indeed, Ed. There's more and more serious talk about the common market than ever. The nations of that big, disjointed continent have always looked outward, and now they're beginning to pull together. And President Juscelino Kubitschek's Operation Pan America, I think, is a very big thing.
Niven, why don't you sum up the last year as viewed from the Soviet Union?
Soviet power kept on growing in 1958, Ed, and communist influence in the world with it. But paradoxically, the Russians chalked up hardly any specific successes. They didn't follow up the Sputnik with anything equally spectacular. If they had any new rockets, they didn't parade them. Diplomatically, they spent the first part of the year yelling for an unprepared summit meeting and for an unenforced ban on nuclear tests. They didn't get either, and they did not get the propaganda mileage they expected. They made a lot of noise about our landings in Lebanon and Jordan, and then about Quemoy. We held the line in both places, for the moment at least. The execution of Imre Nagy and the intimidation of Boris Pasternak showed the communist system at its ugliest. So did the craven confession of fallen Premier Bulganin this month. But the Russians are not worried. The book tells them that history is on their side. Opening the world's largest hydroelectric dam, announcing a new 7-year plan, a further expansion of education, they plot away toward their goal, world communism. And they work with a concentration of effort and resources that's perhaps peculiar to communism and is certainly unattainable in any free society.
Well, next, the cynical sage of Foggy Bottom, Eric Severide.
Edward, I am chairman of the independent pessimist, but I'm not a cynic. Well, we did a lot of things this year in this country, Ed. No one seems to stand out. We did get into space finally. I think we really did begin to shake up our educational system, and of course we brought in a 49th state. We suffered the worst recession of the decade, but we got through it pretty well, partly because of the sheer size of our defense spending. In foreign affairs, we continued to react. We reacted very sharply this year in Quemoy and Lebanon. But so far as I can see, we took no strong initiatives of our own in foreign affairs. And I can't see that any of the important international conferences this year was conclusive. There's been a growth of a whole mass of unsolved problems, both domestic, down to the community level, and foreign. And this, I think, as it piled up, has produced a kind of public sense of frustration and unease in this country. And I think that is what resulted in the big new crop of young and very activist congressmen this fall. I think their eagerness for action may be somewhat stronger than their prospects for success.
Well, you end as you began, on a note of pessimism. That's very good. Gentlemen, what are the flashpoints right now, the imminent dangers in your area? Leiser, obviously it's Berlin for you.
Yes, Ed, and one of the imminent dangers facing us in Berlin is a very definite possibility of World War III. We and the Soviets are almost literally sitting on a time bomb there, with the fuse ticking away toward the June 1st deadline that Moscow has set for us to negotiate or get out of town. I don't think, Ed, that Soviet troops will try to expel our garrisons from Berlin by force. This would mean massive retaliation, and they know that, and I think they don't feel that they have to do this. Nor, if the Russians turn over their controls to the East German communists, as they've said they'll do, and the East Germans try to limit our free access to Berlin, do I think that we'll start a fight, at least at that point. As I indicated a few minutes ago, present plans, at least, call for us to fly over a blockade, as we did in 48, rather than attempt to force through it on the ground. But both the Russians and the East Germans have implied very strongly that this time they'll regard an airlift as a violation of East German territory, and that they'll shoot our planes down. If this happens, it will be very hard to avoid a war.
I'd like to ask Dave. About 20 years ago, the French asked themselves, why die for Danzig? And they fell apart, and Hitler walked all over them. Are they now asking themselves, why die for Berlin?
Well, no, Richard, they're not. As Ed Murrow told us a short while ago, all 15 of the NATO allies stood up in Paris about 10 days ago. Each one pledged himself to support Berlin, and one of the leaders in that pledge was Charles de Gaulle. I think that you all know, many of you were with him all through the war, that Charles de Gaulle is not the sort of man to be a coward, to back down under pressure. I think the answer is the French are ready to defend Berlin. But if I might throw one at Ernie, I'm quite astonished to hear you talk about the very definite possibility of World War III. I don't get that kind of mood over in our area, not in NATO, nowhere else. The possibility of war is always with us, always has been. The possibility of World War III in Berlin, Ernest, now, how do you read that?
Well, perhaps it's because you're one country removed, David, but what would you think would happen if we flew our airlift planes into Berlin and they were shot down by East German anti-aircraft or forced down by East German planes?
I think we'd raise a terrible fuss the way we did when the Russians shot down our planes, and they've done that several times in the past 10 years. I think that
over their territory.
I don't care what territory. We're not going to bomb Moscow. We're not going to send our armies into action against the Red Army. I think there'll be clashes, trouble, fright. I certainly don't see, and I wonder whether anybody at this table does, the possibility of World War III coming out of Germans shooting down airlift planes.
But look, Dave, there's absolutely no room for maneuver in Berlin. Yeah. If we get through to Berlin and succeed in supplying and sustaining the city, it will be a defeat for the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union has now committed itself publicly to getting us out of Berlin.
We defeated them 10 years ago on the same issue, and they did nothing about it.
Yes, but there's no place to go. If you don't get into Berlin, Berlin dies.
They can't keep us out of Berlin. We have a year's supply of food in Berlin already. If they send planes against our planes, we'll send fighter planes up, and maybe there'll be an air war over the corridor.
This is what the question I'd like to ask you then, David. What makes you think that an air war can be a limited air war? When our fighter planes are fighting the Soviet planes, and the Soviets have said they'll come to the support of the East Germans if needed, then I don't see how the conflict can be really limited.
But wars don't begin in mechanical situations like that, Ernie. They begin where there's some will to fight somewhere.
There's something
they'll
fight for.
Anything of that kind exists.
Well, how can you be sure that nowadays, when it takes only one person to
start? The answer is that we can't be sure.
Well, we're not trying to be sure. We're arguing about probabilities.
On that, we're agreed, at least. Kalischer, Who's bluffing whom in the Far East and where?
Well, why die for Kimoi? That's what Kimoi was supposed to find out, the answer to that question. There was brinksmanship on both sides there, and I think in 1959 the communists are going to have another go at the offshore islands. And if not there, somewhere else on the periphery of China. They're muscle flexing all over the place. There's going to be a rumpus when Singapore holds elections in March. It's almost certain to go communist or way left. There may be eruptions in Thailand and Burma, which recently went under mild military dictatorships. At any rate, it ain't going to be a quiet year in the Far East.
Burdett, what about the Middle East?
Well, the revolution in Iraq has created a new kind of situation in the Middle East with new dangers. I think it can be summed up by saying that now that the West has been evicted from most of its key political positions, the interests of Khrushchev and the interests of Nasser are no longer identical. Egypt wishes to see the new Iraq closely aligned someday with Nasser's Arab Union. The Russians want Iraq to keep her present independence so that they can use her more freely as a base of operations against Iran and Turkey and against Western interests in the Persian Gulf. And so today the Russians are actively sabotaging Nasser's dream of Arab unity, with the Syrian communists preaching subversion and the Iraqi communists fighting Nasserism. Well, in all of this, there's an immediate danger. The new nationalist government of Iraq wants to maintain independence of Egypt and to assert a nationalism independent of Nasser, which is a good and healthy thing. But in striking down the pro-Nasser forces, as it has done, the Iraqi government has had to rely on communist support to carry the day. The communists now provide the government's main support outside the army. And as a consequence, Iraq now faces the danger of heavy communist infiltration on the most important levels of government. Of course, there can never be real tranquility in the Middle East until there's an Arab-Israeli settlement, and there's always the danger of the collapse of Jordan, which continues to live miraculously on borrowed time.
Schoenbrunn, do you sense any imminent dangers?
Well, in France, there are no new dangers, Ed, but most of the old ones are still imminent. Financial bankruptcy and the Algerian war, I'd say, are the most dangerous.
What are the dangers over the horizon in Russia, Nevin?
We've all been talking about the dangers the Russians confront us with, but they also face some troubles of their own. Their people, receiving more consumer goods, are still not satisfied. The more they get, the more they want. The country becomes more bourgeois every year. A lot of people are more interested in getting a car or a television set than in building socialism. There's always the danger of new trouble in the satellites. And to the east, the Russians see a nation with three times their population working much harder at building socialism. They wonder if the Chinese will someday be in a position to treat them the same way they are now treating Eastern Europe. But despite these domestic and empire troubles, the Westerner comes away from the Soviet Union much more impressed by its strength than by its weaknesses.
Eric Severide.
Ed, I really think that our own clear and present danger is that this administration at Washington is too old and too tired to cope with much beside the routine housekeeping chores of government. Certainly in terms of fresh ideas, it's a petrified forest. There's a whole new world of events and problems, pressures bursting out everywhere, here and abroad. And I think as the biggest democratic country that a very tremendous American drive and initiative are absolutely necessary even to keep even with all this. So you can't help but get considerably worried when the chief executive's chief personal passion is simply to pare down the money costs of government.
Well, most of you gentlemen, except Severide and myself, have spent the last year looking at this country from the outside. Leiser, how do we look from Germany?
Well, in all West Europe, Ed, I think that our prestige is higher now than it was last year at this time. Our allies there always hope that we'll stand firm without being belligerent, and I think we've done that to their satisfaction in Berlin, at least so far. And then last year, the beep of the Soviet Sputnik was the only sound from space, and our own earthbound voice was one of chagrin, outrage, and fear. Now we're up in space, too, in a pretty impressive way. On the very day that we launched our big talking satellite, the Russian commander in Berlin was talking too, talking very tough. But our Atlas got a lot more attention from the Berliners than his saber rattling. The Germans are impressed by power, and we've demonstrated that we've still got it. Our smaller allies are reassured by determination, at least so long as it's directed to their defense. The French, to judge by my trips to Paris this year, don't really like us or respect us much more, But then the French don't really like anyone very much. Including themselves, I think. Or am I putting it too strongly, Dave?
No, it's absolutely right, Ernie. And as for their attitude towards America, they think that if they kick us, they become a world power automatically.
They have no monopoly on that attitude, have they? Burdett, how do we look as viewed from the Middle East?
In the Arab part of the Middle East, the United States faces the profound instinctive mistrust of the Arab nationalists, and we are still very far from overcoming it. We're still regarded as the country that refused to invest in an Egypt that was taking arms from the Russians. The country that decided not to help build the Aswan Dam when we discovered that the Russians were not interested in building it. And the country that boycotted Egypt for nearly 2 years after the Suez Crisis. I think we'll have to do something radically new to convince the Arabs that we are not interested in them merely because we are afraid of the Russians.
Pete Kalischer, what's our picture in the Far East?
Well, Ed, in communist China, we're public enemy number one with a bang. In South Korea and South Vietnam, the anti-communist bastions we've erected, we look pretty good, particularly after Kim Oi. In the neutral countries like Burma and India, we look better than we did last year, maybe because our foreign policymakers no longer treat neutralism as a dirty word. But we're still regarded in these neutral countries as well-meaning peck's bad boys playing with matches in military bases. And in Japan, these bases are regarded as the accommodation you must make to your best customer.
Dick Hottollett, what's the view from south of the border?
We look better in the Western Hemisphere than we have in some time. We've changed our policy toward Latin America to support a regional development fund and a common market. It's a very important change, and it's much appreciated. But we still somehow too often miss the meeting of minds that engenders real cordiality. Of course, both sides have got to work at friendship. But we, for one thing, annoy the Latinos when we smile at their dreams and tell them to be practical. This is well meant, and it's quite right. But the problems in South America are so huge that common sense alone is not enough. Up north, we keep having family difficulties with Canada, which feels penetrated and dominated by U.S. capital and frustrated by our protectionist economic measures. By and large, I'd say that we're falling down in a field where we usually excel. We're just not communicating right.
Charles Collingwood, how do we look from London?
Well, the British, having accepted American leadership in the West, are not immune to the thought that they could manage these things better if the leadership were still with them as it once was. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, they think we've done pretty well lately. An interesting thing in the last year has been the decline of President Eisenhower as a symbol of America's role as leader. When the British talk about American foreign policy, they tend to talk in terms of Dulles, not of Eisenhower. Vice President Nixon's visit to England and what he said there made more impact than anything that's come from the White House. British also tend to be a little skeptical about the tone and style with which we present ourselves to the world and advertise our policies. They were tremendously impressed by the technical achievement of getting an Atlas into orbit. But when it began to talk, they thought it rather an odd thing to say from a military missile.
Well, gentlemen, let's pause at this point, so that our stations may identify themselves.
This is the CBS Radio Network. Now again, here is Edward R. Murrow with Years of Crisis.
You fellows began by reporting very briefly what you regarded as the really important development in your area in the past decade. Now, before we start guessing about what's going to happen in the future, let's go back to that one for a moment. Schoenbrunn, what would you regard as the most important development in Europe in the last 10 years?
Well, Ed, perhaps I'd first, better say that the most important developments are often not the most spectacular, and that has been the case in my area in the past decade. The most spectacular development has been the rise and fall of French governments ending this year and the death of the Fourth Republic. It was important, but I think less important than the birth and growth of European economic unity among six nations. The core of this union, of course, is the reconciliation of the French and German people, united for the first time in history in a common market without trade barriers, which begins its first stage operations just 4 days from now. This is a reversal of history with great promise for the future peace and progress of Europe. Now, this European Union has developed behind the shield of NATO, and the building of this defensive shield is itself one of the most important developments of the past decade, for it has helped include Germany in the Western Alliance for the first time. There's been a solidification, a consolidation of the balance of power On our side of the line, three-quarters of the German nation are now with the West, and the great story in that area is the tremendous upsurge of power, the renaissance of Germany during this period. Now, I suggest that had such a strong alliance for peace been created in 1913 or 1938, then World War might not have broken out.
I think we'd all agree with you on that. Tell us you're the most important development in the Far East in the last decade.
10 years ago, Ed, the communists won control of a prostrate China. We faced the choice then of recognizing the new government or stringing along with Chiang Kai-shek. We did not recognize the communists, and in a larger sense, I think we didn't recognize the social upheaval shaking all Asia, of which China was the most radical and unfriendly example. At the outset, the communists arrested our consul in Mukden, seized American property, uprooted Western institutions, jailed nuns and priests. When Red China entered the Korean War, the door slammed between us. Since then, our policy has been to isolate communist China economically, politically, militarily. This policy has failed. Although we have kept Red China out of the United Nations, and incidentally, American correspondents out of Red China, most of the rest of Asia have diplomatic and commercial relations with Peking. To them, Formosa and the nationalists, however virtuous, are a dead end. To millions and millions of Asians, mainland China is a gigantic mirror that 10 years ago reflected the famine and population problems of India, the industrial backwardness of Burma and Indonesia, the graft endemic all over Southeast Asia. Today, these unsteady, newly independent nations see a China of 650 million people a world power. They see a communist government overcoming these problems, and you'll have to accept the word of a dozen British, Canadian, German, and Swiss correspondents who've been there that they are overcoming them. The communists have brought order out of chaos. They have boosted productions. The communes do work, at least for the moment. And they're going about the job with a national vitality and ambition and ruthlessness that is outspeeding any social experiment of our lifetime. They see this way of life, these floundering nations like India. They're fascinated by it, they're afraid of it, and they might buy it.
Burdett, the 10-year view from the Middle East.
Well, in the Middle East, the main development, the rise of Arab nationalism in these past 10 years, has presented a curious paradox to Western eyes. The Arab nations are in themselves weak, and yet the greatest powers on earth have been at the mercy of this force, the Arab nationalist movement. Because the Arab states are weak, the West again and again has underestimated the basic force of Arab nationalism, and again has been led into frustration and bafflement and anger. Weak as the Arabs are, the West nevertheless has been compelled by a simple political condition to surrender one after another of its positions, and we have seen the British lose their hold in turn on Egypt and Jordan and then Suez and finally Iraq. Arab nationalism has succeeded as fast as it has, largely because of the kind of age in which we live. This is not an age in which gunboat diplomacy can solve anything. One of the greatest gunboat ventures of all time, the Anglo-French invasion of Egypt, ended in humiliation. It's an age in which every small crisis at once becomes a world crisis that is floodlighted at the United Nations. Every small shift of power in the Middle East, every passage of arms, every trade or aid agreement at once becomes a big power affair. It's an age in which the little nations can thus keep the big powers on a string, as Nasser has kept the United States, by playing the Russians off against us. Nasser became a pan-Arab hero when he discovered the infinite possibilities of that game. At the end of 10 years, we find that two great changes have taken place. Arab nationalism has established itself as a basic political condition, and the Russians have established their permanent interest in Middle East affairs. These two facts may be extremely uncomfortable for different reasons, but they are both inescapable today.
Collingwood? These last 10 years haven't been easy for the British. They've had to rebuild from the destruction of the Second World War. Their economy has been teetering on the knife edge of chronic crisis. They've seen their empire go, their old proud place in the world superseded. They've been forced to call into question most of the assumptions on which their life had been based. And the most important thing that's happened to them in the last 10 years is that facing up to these things, they've begun to shape a new kind of Britain. Today, Britain is more prosperous than it's been for a long time. Its considerable social revolution goes on apace. In international affairs, if its voice is not as strong as it was, it's nonetheless heard. The British have drawn the logical conclusion from the shift in world power and have firmly tied themselves to the United States in a unique relationship which Prime Minister Macmillan, and I suppose President Eisenhower, calls interdependence, which means accepting American leadership. Sometimes the British chafe at it, but they have not been too proud to accept it. It has been, this decade, and to some extent still is, a painful emotional experience for the British. But in that time, they have come to recognize their changed position in a changed world.
Huddlehead, how about the last 10 years in Latin America?
After 10 years of boom and bust, of profligate dictatorship and wasteful welfare state, the leaders of Latin America and the immensely increasing number of people with them have decided to try the free road. In one country, things are so unsettled that the army should be getting ready for another revolution. But the senior military commander told me that a new strong man would not be the answer, that only a democratic regime could solve the underlying social and economic problems. And that, I think, is eloquent testimony. After generations of dictatorship, the tide of freedom has never been so high. But democracy also faces its most serious test right now, the political strain of economic readjustment.
Well, Eric, the last 10 years, 6 years of Eisenhower, 4 years of Truman. How's it been?
Ed, it's been a fascinating story, and I think the basic theme in it has been this business of proud, isolated, independent America coping with the realities of the world from which we could not escape. We started out well. We thought it wouldn't be too hard, this new role. We did save Greece. We did save Berlin in an airlift some 10 years ago. The Marshall Plan worked, and things got very tough and dangerous, surprisingly so for most of us, in Korea. And then, of course, we lost our ace in the hole, our monopoly of the atomic weapon. And China was lost to the other side. These were the great setbacks of this period. It disturbed Americans very much who were new at this kind of a world game. So we did adopt for a while this devil-in-the-midst theory to explain the troubles. We hunted for a villain, then we hunted for a hero to vanquish all the villains, overseas and domestic. And a lot of us thought, at least for a while, that we'd found him in a rather charming wartime general. The trouble here was, at home, was that both sides politically thought he was their hero, those willing to break with the past and those unwilling. He himself seemed very willing in world affairs, but not quite so willing in domestic affairs. But there's been, of course, no escape from these realities. The military budgets, foreign aid programs, the rest of it, all reflect this. And in these 10 years, Ed, we've added 30 million more Americans. Now, That meant the crowding of our facilities. It meant governmental collective ways of settling problems. This sealed in the New Deal. Welfare government of a kind became a permanent, unquestionable thing. And all these pressures meant, I think, the disintegration of the traditional conservative political forces which were based on the past, because most of the links with the past were being broken.
Well, fellows, so far we've been juggling little hemispheres. Let's go up into space and get the global view. Which of all these events would you say is the most important, Schoenbrunn?
I think a twin development, Ed, the surge of Soviet power and the antibody it engendered, the Atlantic Alliance.
Winston?
I would say what Paul Niven has been talking about, the growth of Soviet power. 10 years ago, the peace was kept by our possession of the atomic bomb, and today it's being kept through a balance of fear.
Pete, what about the Far East?
Well, I'll have to go back to communist China, its rise as a major power and a Soviet ally, perhaps one day to eclipse the Soviet Union.
Paul Niven.
The growth of Soviet power, again, and the growing importance of science, two trends that all too often have coincided.
Adelette, what do you say is the big thing that happened?
I'd say it was the inclusion of Germany in the Western Alliance for the first time in 1,000 years. It's this that's made it possible for us to hold our central position in Europe.
Eric?
I'd say the volcanic force of the effects of the world population explosion, and I'd say the growth of knowledge. The scientific revolution, which somehow has got to neutralize the effects of this population explosion.
Ernie, what would you say?
Despite the Berlin crisis, Ed, I'd say it's been the abrupt shift in direction of the Soviet drive to expand power away from Europe and toward easier targets of opportunity in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East.
I'm not sure I agree with any of you. It seems to me that the major development has been the fact that this country has reversed its traditional policy and gone out into the world. And that if we had not done that, starting in 1948, perhaps none of us would be here now. And as a corollary to that, the fact that we have become so enthralled and entranced by the Russians that we regard our activities in relation to theirs rather than relying on our own strength and our own traditions. Well, gentlemen, I think you'd agree that in the public mind, large chunks of history are sometimes associated with a phrase, a catchword, a slogan, which serves for a time and then suddenly becomes outmoded and appears a little ridiculous, at least no longer applicable. Let's find some of these catchwords or slogans that are now obsolete. Schoenbrunn?
Well, liberté, égalité, fraternité have not really been forgotten in France, but they're more than somewhat frayed. I think France is haunted by the ghost of Louis XIV.
Burdett?
Well, I think in the Arab world it means something today that you no longer hear the war cry, drive the Israelis into the sea. And I guess that's because more and more Arabs begin to realize that Israel is here to stay.
Is it that you don't hear it, or is it still there?
I think the desire is still there, but the possibility of realizing it, everyone now sees, is no longer there.
Kalischer, any old slogans today?
Well, it's been a long time since I heard anybody talk about unleashing Chiang Kai-shek.
Paul Niven.
In the Kremlin, the phrase collective leadership has gone out of fashion. The pictures of Khrushchev are getting bigger and bigger.
Dick Hollett.
The old image of the banana republic that could be pushed around has faded away, and for a long while it looked as though send the Marines was a dead letter too, until that was briefly and unhappily revived last spring.
Eric?
Well, communism, Korea, and corruption now sounds rather embarrassing after this passage of time, and so do a bigger bang for a buck. So does massive retaliation.
Ernie, what don't you hear in Germany?
Well, we don't hear much on the East German border about rolling back the Iron Curtain anymore, nor in East Europe about national communism or the Polish road to socialism. Now all roads lead to Moscow. In West Europe, the phrase U.S. go home isn't very current.
Collingwood?
What about the sun never sets on the British Empire? I just come back from Africa.
Well, if I might sum up what you gentlemen have said in part so far, at least, it would seem that you're still only half safe. But now, fellows, let's look into the future. What do you fellows see as the most important development in the next 10 years? Schoenbrunn?
Ed, the next 10 years are in some respects easier to predict in France than the next year. 10 years from now, France will no longer have a colonial problem, for there won't be any French colonies left. And Algeria, I think, will be free and independent. This will force France to devote her extraordinary talents to seeking strength in European Union instead of dreams of empire. As for that European Union, Ed, I think it will progress from its present economic base towards a political union, the United States of Europe. Now, this will be a long, bumpy road with many detours and deviations in it, but I think it's the road of the future, if there is no war. And I believe today, as I did 10 years ago when you first asked us that question, that there will be no war. If I'm right, then a fuller and better future awaits us and our children. And if I'm wrong, none of you gentlemen are going to be around to contradict me.
I think you're right about that. Burdett?
Well, in the Middle East, I'd say that the perspective for the next 10 years is something like this. The basic political condition there is still Arab nationalism. It is a movement that is still in flood. And one of the driving forces behind it is the ambition of the Arab states to equip themselves as modern nations. They can't possibly do this alone. Even the richest of the oil states has to depend on outside aid or guidance to fulfill the goals of the nationalist revolution. The question is, will the new nationalist regimes be able to do it? Will they be able to move fast enough? Or will the revolutionary impetus that brought them to power finally drive them from power, with the Arabs turning in frustration to extreme political measures under extreme leadership? Of course, these are questions for the future, but right now they're greatly sharpened by the new game that the Russians are playing in the Middle East. It means a new and sharper challenge for the West in the coming years. And to meet it, the United States must come up with a policy of aid far bolder and more flexible than anything we've had so far. In the next decade, we can lose entirely our power to influence events in the Middle East if we simply go on stalling from crisis to crisis.
Pete Kalischer, how about the future in Asia?
Well, I'm at a distance from my local tea leaf reader, but I'd say that in the next 10 years, the big thing will be the frightening expansion and industrialization of communist China and our as yet inability to cope with it. To give an example, until last year, Japan regarded Red China as a juicy potential customer. This year, China is a competitor. Its textiles and radios are underselling Japan's in Southeast Asia. Like Russia, China is now dispensing foreign aid, only a little and at great sacrifice at home. But doing so at all is impressive, particularly in a decisive Asian arena like India. If India cannot make an economic go of it under its democratic socialism, the communists will organize it in China's image.
Paul Niven?
What will happen inside the Soviet Union is just about impossible to predict, now as always. Khrushchev, a resourceful and capable leader, could improve and strengthen Soviet civilization. On the other hand, he could degenerate into the kind of mad old tyrant he used to say Stalin became. Lots of ordinary Russians will tell you there can't be a return to Stalinism. We wouldn't stand for it, they say. Then when you ask them just how they'd go about stopping it, they cannot answer. But either way things go inside the Soviet Union, there's little chance that its challenge to us is going to diminish.
Dick Hotlet, did you find any prophets in Latin America?
Yes, there's some people who say that something will certainly come along to replace the samba. But also, without a Ouija board, you can say that for the next 10 years, the population of Latin America will still further exceed ours and we'll become dependent on them for raw materials and political support. Above all, the next decade is a challenge to show that staggering problems can be overcome in terms of liberal democracy. Brazil alone, with its large non-white population, would be an object lesson to Asia and Africa that democracy does pay and that Moscow's cry of Yankee imperialism is rubbish. You don't need an ant-heap society to get spectacular results. Take Brasilia, the new capital of Brazil, a city for 500,000 people now being built in the middle of nowhere. Right now, a road 1,300 miles long is being cut to the north, hundreds of miles of it through virgin tropical rainforest. The construction crews are being supplied by air. And when the two spearhead bulldozers meet next month, it'll be the biggest thing of its kind since the Golden Spike was driven on our own Union Pacific Railroad. The cost is immense. It comes at a time when inflation is ruinous. But 20 years from now, no one will ask what Brasilia cost. The Brazilians and we, too, will be thankful that this dream was made to come true. If this and the greater experiment do not succeed, there'll be trouble. The communists and their cousins, the extreme nationalists, are in the wings, ready to move in. And the next round of dictatorship in Latin America, if there should be one, would not warm up anachronisms like Trujillo. It would rest on men like Juan Perón, who manipulate the masses and try to ride Moscow's tiger.
Lazar, what do you see happening in the next 10 years?
Well, Ed, the Soviet ultimatum on Berlin expires in just 5 months, and despite the calm confidence of David Schoenbrunn, I don't think that anybody can safely forecast what will happen when the ultimatum does expire. But if Berlin doesn't touch off the big explosion, I would guess that the power balance in Central Europe will not shift a great deal in the 10 years ahead. And I would also guess that Germany will probably remain split. I'd like to suggest that there are worse things for us than Germany's division, at least so long as three-quarters of the German people and economy are on our side of the line. And in satellite East Europe, which includes nearly 100 million people, I think that in the next decade we'll see a strengthening of Russia's status quo. Even if Soviet troops are withdrawn from all or part of that area, and this is possible, it will happen only when Moscow is sure that its own people are securely in control. If the Russians turn out to be wrong, then they'll find some excuse to march back in again to regain control, just as they did in Hungary. But they probably won't have to. The dominant mood in the satellites now is one of resignation, and I think it's going to stay that way.
Collingwood, you've just come back from an assignment in Africa. Is Africa coming unstuck?
It's coming apart, and the process will be hastened in the next 10 years. In that time, I think the problem of how Africa will put itself together again will be of crucial importance. I think it very possible that Africa will be to the next 10 years what the Middle East has been to the last, an area whose political evolution is so intimately engaged with the interests of the great powers that the issue of world peace or world war can hang upon the outcome. In this next 10 years, most of Africa is going to achieve its independence and autonomy. It will be extremely unstable, prey to shifting influences, and of acute interest to both Russia and the West. We're all pretty ignorant of Africa today, but 10 years from now, we aren't going to be.
Eric?
Well, Ed, I don't believe in the old one-world theory that the whole world must be either communist or democratic. I think both sides will exist. Both sides may even grow a little stronger. I don't think the next few years will irrevocably tip the balance one way or another for the whole globe. I also think this scientific revolution may affect individual lives in nearly all countries, even more than political philosophies and systems. Here in our own country, Ed, I think these 10 years will certainly see a decrease, some more, in the manual laboring class, fewer individual farms, bigger business monopolies or semi-monopolies. We may see a 4.5-day work week for most workers.
And, Ed, this means a leisure problem, a cultural problem that could get all out of joint. It's beginning to already. Because it will be the least educated who will have most of the time and the leisure for recreation and reading and travel and so on, it won't be the best educated, the most successful people. So our public scene here in America could become, unless our educational system gets hold of it, a kind of a cultural nightmare. We must also get hold of these public life problems of transportation, the hospitals, the water levels, and so on. And I would suspect that at the end of these 10 years, most American Negroes are going to be getting a much more nearly equal education. I hope so. Maybe we'll land a man on the moon, where I think you'll find a Hilton Hotel, incidentally, under Russian management.
Is your credit card up to date, Eric?
Well, gentlemen, just how seriously do you regard this matter of the explosion of population?
Very seriously indeed, Ed. In North Africa, for example, half of the total population is under 21 years of age, and it's just about impossible to keep up with their need for food, schools, and jobs.
Kalisher?
Well, statistics in China are variable, but there are as many babies born every 2 or 3 years in China today as the total population of Italy, 50 million.
Nevin?
Population is just one more thing which a communist government can turn on or off and increase at will whenever it wants.
Within limits.
Within limits.
Winston?
Well, in the Middle East, the problem is staggering. Egypt, for example, Egypt's population is going up so fast by 500,000 a year that the country has to make spectacular strides just to stay in the same place in terms of food and living standards.
Eric?
We've increased about 30 million in the last 10 years, Ed. It's not a profound problem here. It's a temporary current problem of facilities.
Dick Hollett. South America is an empty continent, and the immediate problem is not so much stopping it being filled, but of organizing what's there.
Collingwood?
Africa is one of the few underpopulated areas left in the world, and this fact will be one of the magnets which draw the influence and attention of the overpopulated parts of the world toward it.
Well, gentlemen, as I understand you, none of you expect an immediate or dramatic easement of the existing tension. You believe that we in this country have lost some of our illusions, but that we do not yet recognize the magnitude of the task that confronts us. You have what I would call a modest hope for some improvement in European Union. Regard both Russia and China as subject to internal stresses, but in no danger of collapse. You're concerned about the competition with communism in the underdeveloped areas, and you say that we should recognize that the demand for freedom and independence will not long be denied. And you are particularly concerned that aid to India should be beefed up and that new methods and techniques must be developed if we're to compete with Russia in the economic war that is now underway. You've all recognized, it seems to me, in one way or another, that the United States has gone through what might be called a sort of revolution by consent in its relations with the rest of the world during the past 10 years, and that the next decade may require even more drastic changes in both our policy and our posture. Most of you seem to be as concerned about the population explosion as about the probability of a nuclear explosion. And I gather from what you've said that around the world has done a better job with death control than with birth control. In short, while you all recognize the contribution that this country has made to the free world in men, money, and metals during the last 10 years, none of you has ventured to suggest that the first 10 years of our responsibility and maturity as a world power were the easiest. Good night and good luck.
This has been the 10th annual year-end report with Edward R. Murrow and CBS News correspondents from important news centers around the world. News associate for this program, Edward Bliss, Jr. This has been a CBS News presentation.
You'd be surprised at the number of people who earn the title of stupid the moment they get behind the wheel of a car. And how else can you describe a driver who ignores all the rules of highway safety? You can't call a man smart when his careless driving habits may label him a killer. This is the CBS Radio Network.